Well, I hope you enjoyed your Bible study together. Let me share with you now just a few comments. I'm sure you discovered many more things than I'm going to mention. But let me try to apply the passage we've been looking at more specifically to ourselves in one or two areas and try and draw out maybe one or two of the things that you may not have spotted. The first thing I think one ought to say about this whole passage in Nehemiah is it has a general lesson to teach us, and that is that the people of God will experience opposition. This is, a general truth. The people of God have always had enemies. And they've always had enemies, plural, fundamentally because they have an enemy, singular, a great enemy who's at work to undermine God's purposes in the universe ever since the world began. And you can be sure that no sooner do the people of God show signs of strengthening their position in the world than that enemy action will become apparent. Apostle Paul tells us we wrestle not just against flesh and blood but against spiritual foes in the heavenly places. That's a reality that's always been true, and we need to take account of it. The church, the Christian individual, will always experience opposition, one kind or another. It's inevitable. The second thing I wanted to say by way of general truth in this passage is that although that opposition has a spiritual inspiration ultimately in the devil, in demonic forces, whenever you experience opposition in the people of God or as a Christian individual, you are likely to find it will have a human agency too. In this case, it were these two chaps, Sanballat and Tobiah, wasn't it? You see, it's very easy sometimes to say, oh, the devil is getting at us as a fellowship, say, or as the church nationally, even. But the devil doesn't really have any way of getting at anybody except through human agencies. Think of Judas. He had to find Judas in order to find a way into the 12. He had to have a human agency. In the days of the early church, the false teachers who undermined the fabric of the apostolic church, they were human beings. All right, the devil may have been having a go getting in there amongst them, but they were still human beings that were causing the trouble. And this is another case in point, as I say. There were human agencies that demonic forces were stirring up to make life difficult for the people of God. That's something, again, you will always find. And that has a very real relevance, I think, for us. Because when we talk about opposition, particularly devilish opposition to the people of God, we need to be on the lookout that we aren't one of the devil's conspirators ourselves. Remember how Jesus once had to rebuke Peter. "Get behind me, Satan." Suddenly Jesus was aware that here a human agency right by his side, a friend, had turned into an instrument of satanic temptation. So opposition will always be faced, and that opposition will usually come through human agencies of one kind or another, sometimes from within the visible church, sometimes from without. Now I asked you to look at the tactics which the opposition used, and I'm sure you spotted some of these. There's the tactic, first of all, wasn't there, of insinuation. "You are rebelling against the king, aren't you?" they ask in chapter 2, verse 19. I remember in the 5th century BC, the slightest breath of suspicion of revolution was a very frightening thing. The Persian army was not very merciful towards those that threatened the empire. "You're rebelling against the king?" Oh, that's a very, very nasty thing to accuse anybody of in Nehemiah's position. And then when insinuation didn't work, they turned to ridicule, didn't they? "Oh, that Nehemiah, he's a dreamer," they say in chapter 4, verse 2 and 3. "It'll never happen. Why, the bricks he's building with have all been burned. They're no use anymore. Why, just an animal running over their wall will knock it all down again. It's a pack of cards they're building. It's jerry-built." There are some folk, you know, who find ridicule harder to bear than physical violence. We'd rather be slapped in the face than mocked behind our back, sneered at. And then when ridicule and scorn didn't work, well then they tried actual intimidation, didn't they? They ganged up. Sanballat got all his friends and colleagues around, including the Philistines and the Arabs and the Ammonites. And in 4 verse 7, they all stir up trouble around about Jerusalem, threatening to come in and invade. And these tactics of opposition, they were effective, weren't they? The people were demoralized by them. In these verses from verse 10 down to verse 12, those three verses, it seems as if Nehemiah went through a phase when just about everything that was coming at him was negative. There were the people in Judah saying, the strength of the laborers is giving out, there's so much rabble we cannot build a wall. You can just imagine it, can't you? The people who wanted to work but who'd listened to the ridicule and they were daunted by the size of the task. It's too much, we'll never do it, they were saying. And then there were the enemies sending in their rumors and their fifth column sort of tactics. Before they know it or see us, we're right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to their work. And then there were the people who were closest to these enemy forces round about Jerusalem, who were really getting the wind up and becoming utterly paranoid, weren't they? They came and told us 10 times over. There's a touch of humor in that, isn't there? You can just imagine poor old Nehemiah getting badgered by these people again and again and again. Wherever we turn, they're going to attack us. It's terrible, Nehemiah. What are we going to do? The whole morale of the people was being undermined by this defeatism, by this sense of inferiority and failure. Well, that too is a great lesson, isn't it, for us to note? That the people of God do go through times like this of demoralization. The enemy's opposition sometimes is effective. And we do go through times when we feel paranoid or defeated or unable to go on. What do we need at times like that? Well, Nehemiah shows us some of the things, doesn't he, that we need if we're to work through those sort of periods in the life of the people of God. And the first thing, of course, that we need if we're going to get through that period is leadership. That's what Nehemiah himself supremely provided, wasn't it? In effect, before Nehemiah arrived on the scene, the Jews were in this situation that we find them in the middle of chapter 4 already. I mean, they just couldn't do the work. They were overwhelmed by it. They hadn't got the heart for rebuilding the wall. It had been lying there for ages and no one had done anything about it for lack of leadership. Well, now Nehemiah was there. And as a result of his leadership, it was possible for them to get through this awkward phase of defeatism and demoralization. Notice some of the principles of that leadership that we can learn from his conduct of the affair. The first to notice is the way that he was careful to make clear plans. And did you notice that he did that in secret? Going out by night with nobody with him, surveying the walls, doing a complete circuit, just to size up the problem, to get a clear idea in his mind of the work that needed to be done and how he was going to set about it. He didn't tell any of them, he said, who were going to do the work, what was in his mind. No, it's very wise, you see. If he jumped the gun and told them too early, why then, well, the opposition would have had a chance to muster itself before anything had got going. People could have poo-pooed it. He had to choose the right moment to break the news. It's a wise leader who doesn't show all his cards immediately, you see. He was waiting to see, waiting till he had his plans clear in his mind before he shared it with them. One of the problems, I think, with many leaders in Christian unions and in churches today is that they don't have the time that Nehemiah had to survey things. They live from hand to mouth, coping with crises all the time. So they never get the chance to think strategically, to think ahead, to take a long-term view. It's a wise church, wise Christian union, wise fellowship that gives its leaders that opportunity, the freedom from responsibility to enable them to do as Nehemiah did and get their ideas sorted out, to make plans, to formulate goals. Because that's what leadership and management is very much about. So he made sure he knew what needed to be done. That was the first thing Nehemiah did as leader. And that was enormously important, I think, in the successful opposition the successful tackling that he engaged in of this opposition. If he had been uncertain in his own mind, then when the opposition came, the whole people would have crumpled because he would not have known what to do. It's because he was clear in his own mind, his goals, that the opposition failed. Secondly, and this again is very important as an element in leadership, do you notice how he shared his enthusiasm for the task with the people? When he'd made up his mind what needed to be done, he says to them in chapter 2, verse 17, "You see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let's rebuild the wall of Jerusalem." Now, this is a great mark of a good leader. It's one I wish I had more of myself. The ability to communicate enthusiasm, to share a vision, to make people see what needs to be done and to motivate them in doing it. Notice he appeals to their honour, among other things. "We'll no longer be in disgrace." It's shameful, he says, that the people of God shouldn't have a wall around their city. It's just an embarrassment. "Come on, let's get out of this situation," he says. But notice too, he gives his own testimony of how God had helped him, had led him, guided him. And notice too the prominence of those first person plurals, "let us rebuild." He's not an authoritarian, though he undoubtedly must have commanded some authority there as a deputy of the emperor. There's no, "now you're going to go and do what I tell you." There's a very real sense of personal involvement. This is our task. Let's get on with it. Great lessons there in this infectious enthusiasm that Nehemiah clearly had, and which is the mark of any great leader. Third thing you notice he did, he made sure the people felt appreciated. Now, all these things were very important, you see, when the opposition came. It was out of the morale which he'd built up in the people that was the resource when opposition came that stopped them crumpling. And I think that's what chapter 3 is all about, showing appreciation. Again, now this is something I've only recently learned the importance of and I'm still not very good at doing. But I think that's what chapter 3 is about. Nehemiah here is making quite sure that all the work that is done is written down and recorded and attributed to the individuals and the families that do it. He goes right round the wall, picking out who did what. Not difficult to imagine, isn't it, how that would boost the morale and the self-esteem of the workers. Old Meshullam, the son of Besodiah, in verse 6, would look forward to the day when his grandson would come to him and say, "Gor, granddad, did you build that bit?" Of course, it also gives Nehemiah a chance for a little bit of a backhander at one or two people who were a bit too snooty to get their hands dirty, like the nobles in 3 verse 5, who would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. Well, you can see what that was all about, can't you? Nehemiah had put some foremen in charge of the work who knew how to build walls, but these nobles, who had no idea about building, wearing gold rings was probably more of their scene, didn't fancy being told what to do by these working class people. The fact that these working class people built more walls than they'd had hot dinners had nothing to do with it. They weren't prepared to be told what to do by them. And Nehemiah puts them in their place in his official report too. And it's nice that the ladies get a mention in verse 12. I'm sure you ladies felt a little bit stung by that verse in the hymn, "Ye that are men now serve him." Well, in 3 verse 12, it's nice to note that good old Shalom, son of Heloash, he repaired his section with the help of his daughters. And they get a special mention too. Appreciation then. Recognizing that people had done a lot of hard work and that that work was going to be remembered and recognized and placed on a roll of honor. That sort of ministry of encouragement. It's very important within the people of God if they're going to resist opposition successfully. But when it actually came to the opposition, you'll notice that he applied a threefold formula, and it's one I think which is a very general application illustrated for us here. First of all, Nehemiah, when he's faced with these Sanballat and Tobiah folk, he says, first of all, we must depend on God. He keeps on reiterating that and demonstrating that in his own prayer life. Did you notice how in chapter 4, verse 4, he actually prays against his enemies? Now, sometimes it is necessary to do that in the church. We don't like the idea, maybe, of praying against anybody, but sometimes it is necessary. When opposition is being faced, sometimes we have to ask God to honor his people and his promises Hear us, O God, for we are despised, he says. There's more than one example in the Psalms of a similar prayer to that, praying against the enemy. And prayer keeps coming up again and again, doesn't it? Verse 9 of chapter 4. We prayed to our God and posted a guard. Verse 14. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, he says. Don't be afraid of them. Or verse 20. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. Again and again, he brings this spiritual, God-centered dimension to what's going on. Dependence on God. That's what puts iron in the soul of the people. Nehemiah's faith stirs them up to keep on trusting. The second of this threefold formula is vigilance. Vigilance toward the enemy. There's nothing naive about Nehemiah. No stupid quietism that says, well, let's just trust God and hope they go away. No, he prays and posts a guard. Like Cromwell. Trust in God, but keep your powder dry, he said. There is a certain sort of super spirituality, you know, that thinks that human resources and human means and human organization aren't necessary if we only pray enough about something. Well, it's nonsense. Of course, prayer, dependence on God's enormously important. But vigilance about the enemy. Now, that's something you see illustrated again and again and again throughout the Bible. Watch and pray, says Jesus. Don't be naive about what the devil's up to. You'll need some defenses. You'll need to have a sword in your hand, spears and bows, he says. Let's get organized for our defense. Notice the wise psychology he uses in verse 13. Putting whole clans together at the various weak points in the wall. Did you notice that? And telling them, now you fight for your brothers and your sisters and your wives and your children. Very wise psychology, that. He knew that people would defend with great ferocity when their own were just behind their spears. And notice how he keeps the trumpeter with him. I think that's a very wise move, isn't it? You don't want panic. Put some young fellow in charge of the trumpet, and the first time he hears some animal scuttling in the night, he'll be blowing the trumpet and causing havoc. No, you stay with me, Mr. Trumpeter, he says. I'll tell you when you blow the trumpet. Very wise to keep the channels of communication in his own hands. So vigilance, wisdom in the maintenance of the defenses of the people of God. And finally, and perhaps even most important, persistence. The dogged perseverance of going on with the work. Do you notice how again and again and again he says, we worked with all our heart. We return to the wall, each to his own work. We didn't take off our clothes, he says. I or my brothers or my men or the guards with me, we each had our weapon even when we went for water. Day and night even. They were vigilant and they went on with the work. Now that sort of perseverance is something you don't always see in people. Now people who can be very spiritual, very prayerful, people even who can be very alert to the dangers the church is in, but they can still lack that doggedness. Now, William Carey once said, I can plod. That was my great secret, he said. I can plod. I can persevere with a task. Many of us fail simply through lack of concentration, lack of determination, lack of persistence. There's the threefold formula, then, for resisting the enemy. Dependence on God, vigilance about the devil's wiles, and persistence in the work. A sword in one hand, a trowel in the other, he says. Those of you who are members of the church here, you know that at Eden we are praying at the moment about what God wants us to do in the future regarding the growth of our own church. Inevitably, any such plans as that will attract opposition. The devil will not be pleased, even for us to start thinking about growing as a church, going somewhere as a church. But if we're going to resist that opposition, if the work is going to be done, then here are some of the things we need to be looking for. We need to be clear about our goals. We need to be able to share enthusiasm with one another, to motivate one another. We need to be able to encourage one another, to make one another feel appreciated in the task, so no one's left out. And we need this threefold formula of defense: depending on God in prayer, vigilance toward the forces that would seek to distract us and to deter us, and persistence in the work. Dogged, daily persistence. Let's take just a few minutes together in prayer. Maybe a few of you would like to lead us in prayers that would apply some of these lessons to our hearts and help us to take them home with us. Do feel free to lead us.